From the highlands of Angola, life-giving water flows into the rivers of the Okavango Delta in northwestern Botswana. The delta is one of the largest freshwater wetlands in southern Africa and one of the last untouched wilderness areas on the continent. This biodiverse region in the midst of the Kalahari Desert supplies water to more than a million people and supports an abundance of wildlife. And like so many wild places on our planet, it's under threat. Work to truly understand and protect it began in 2015. Since then, intrepid teams of researchers have systematically explored the major rivers of the Delta, traveling thousands of kilometers in hand-dug canoes called Mokoros and collecting vast quantities of data on every aspect of the environment, including water quality, water discharge, biodiversity, and climate. The Okavango Wilderness Project, a partnership between the Wild Bird Trust and National Geographic, is an endeavor without end. The teams return year after year to expand their catalog of data, which they share with regional governments and other stakeholders to increase awareness of the region's health and encourage action to protect it. These scientists risk life and limb to travel these wild rivers, collecting not only invaluable information, but also experiences of a lifetime. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Aquapod, where we share water monitoring stories from the field. I'm Helen Taylor, content manager with InSitu.
And I'm Carrie Caslow, InSitu's application development manager for surface water.
In late 2021, I learned about a research team using InSitu instrumentation as part of a wide-ranging project in the Okavango River Basin in southern Africa. The National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project, now in its eighth year, conducts annual transects of the rivers in the basin to collect baseline data on multiple parameters. They also collect continuous data at multiple remote monitoring stations throughout the region. Documenting the Okavango ecosystem year after year, teams have accumulated enormous amounts of information and made it available to the scientists, policymakers, and governments seeking to protect this biodiverse region and precious water source. As you can imagine, given their frequent and extended expeditions, it was a little tough to pin them down. So we are thrilled to have with us today the project's research director, Reiner van Brandis, and research and collections manager, Gertz Nief, along with Gwabaone Ramatlapeng, a PhD candidate at UC Davis, who is from Botswana and is analyzing the collected data with plans to join the team next year. Welcome to you all.
Thank you. Hi.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's get started. We're very excited to have you here. Reiner, I just described the project in a nutshell, but please take a few minutes and give us a more thorough overview of the Okavango Wilderness Project, the geography of the region, how and why the project took shape, and maybe a little bit about where things stand today.
Okay. Back in 2009, our founder, Dr. Steve Boyce, he was living and working in the Okavango Delta, working at a lodge, in fact. Soon, you know, started just traveling more broadly across the Delta. He found this old Mokoro that was abandoned. A Mokoro is a dugout canoe, a traditional dugout canoe. And he started just traveling a bit more widely over the Okavango Delta. During 2009, he eventually crossed the whole Okavango Delta. It's about 350 kilometers or so with these Mokoro to do a wetland bird survey, using birds as indicators of habitat health. After doing this for a couple of years, he realized, you know, the water that comes into the Okavango Delta actually comes from much further away. It comes from Angola. And Angola had been at war for a long time. It had been, you know, several years since the war had ended, things had calmed down there. So he managed to create a partnership with National Geographic. National Geographic provided some funding, and our mother organization, the Wild Bird Trust, then through the partnership with National Geographic, formed the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project. And the aim of the project back in those days was to just really have, you know, do a full exploration of the entire basin, not just the delta, which is at the end of the basin, but to very importantly find out what's going on in the headwaters of the Okavango. Okavango flows through three countries. It starts in Angola, and then it runs along Namibia, and then into Botswana, where it very quickly becomes the Okavango Delta. So Steve and Gertz was part of this expedition. They went up in 2015 and 16, and they ended up doing an expedition called Source to Sand. And this is also the Into the Okavango film that you can find online. I think it's on Disney Plus at the moment. That's where that film was made. It's a story about this expedition, which took several months, and they went from the top of the basin to the through the delta to Naipan, which is right where the water disappears back into the sand again. After this expedition, we realized there's obviously big tributaries to the river, so we started doing expeditions down these tributaries as well, the Quito River, the Quanafal River, and then later other rivers as well. Now we've done over 20,000 kilometers in this way. We've improved the technology and our research methodology, and in 2017, we started using aquatrols to monitor water quality, roughly every 10 Ks as we went down the river. So you can imagine how many aquatrol readings we've taken. And, you know, then we realized permanent stations are a good idea as well, so that we can have a permanent flow of information, water quality, water discharge, weather. And we installed, now we have 13 of these things. And now we received more funding. We also have, through the Okavango Eternal Program, we have funding and partnership with De Beers. And we are now doing more targeted conservation work. We've got a laboratory in Maun in Botswana. We've got a laboratory up in the Angolan Highlands, where we are trying to implement these community conservation areas, small protected areas that are managed by the communities, to safeguard the sources of the Okavango.
And when you say we, can you describe the teams, I guess, there? More than one, right?
I mean, in the beginning, it was really Gertz. Gertz was there from the very beginning. I mean, it was a team of, what, five or six people, Gertz, right?
Yeah.
And now we are over 60 people at the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project. So it's grown tremendously. You know, there's permanent staff in Angola, Namibia, and Botswana, all locally hired people. We probably are a team of 10 scientists, and then just a lot of hardcore expedition stuff.
Wonderful.
So tell us a little bit more about kind of everything that you're monitoring. It's not just the water quality. You mentioned that it started with some wetland birds, but what else are you guys looking at in this project?
So we count all biodiversity that we see. So we collect data in three ways, really. We do a continuous count as we go down the river. So you have an observer and a recorder, several of them in the Mokoros, in the dugout canoes. All the biodiversity that we see, we count out as we go along and enter that on a geotagged data collection system. So that includes animals, birds. Then we count all the people that we see. What are they doing? Are they fishing? Are they, collecting water? How are they doing these things? So that we can work out, you know, the impact of people on the rivers and to see if the river is in fact providing the ecosystem services that the people want from the river. We then, of course, use the aquatrols to monitor water quality. We have an acoustic Doppler current profiler and ADCP to do on-the-spot water discharge measurement. It's part of Gertz's PhD. We collect eDNA, environmental DNA, to see, you know, what fishes and macroinvertebrates are there. We do a macroinvertebrate assessment. We use macroinvertebrates as bioindicators to tells you a lot about the river's health. We fly drones around and do permanent long-term photography with drones. We do 3D riparian vegetation monitoring with drones. what am I missing goods? We put out fike nets at night to trap fish to see, you know, to so that we can relate that to the eDNA data. We put out bat recorders and frog recorders, and a couple of other things that I may be missing. We collect pretty much everything that we can.
The other cool thing we do is our 360-degree camera, which takes a picture every minute. And in the end, after an expedition, it gets all put together. Then you get a sort of Google Street View of the whole river.
First of all, how long are these expeditions when you're actually out there? How long are you out there for?
Gertz, you want to answer this one?
Yeah. Our expeditions range from, I think, sort of from the shortest ones are about 2 to 3 weeks. And then they go up to about 6 weeks. In the beginning, I think we're a bit more optimistic and thought people can and want to do longer expeditions. Like the first expedition Rainer mentioned in 2015, the source to sand, that took 121 days. So that was quite long. But yeah, these days we try to limit our expedition time to sort of 6 weeks per expedition. And as our team grows, we do have more researchers and we can tag team rivers and do different sections. Different people can do different sections. So yeah, that's the advantage of having a bigger team.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you guys actually prepare for these expeditions? I'm sure there's a lot of work that goes into it. And then maybe if you can tell us a little bit about what a day on the river looks like.
So yeah, obviously a lot of work goes into preparing for an expedition. And over the years, in 2015, it was all just thrown together and we weren't as prepared as we are now. And again, with a growing team, we've got a team, an operations team and a logistics team that do all the sort of all the hard pre-expedition work where they pack everything for us and just make sure that we have everything we need, from having power, solar panels with batteries to make sure that we can upload our data, that our cameras are running, and working with National Geographic, and we always have some sort of photographers or videographers with us. So yeah, we do have to make sure our sort of power supply is there for those people and for us to make sure our data is uploaded to the cloud and is safeguarded. So if your cell phone falls into the water, that the data is not lost. There's a whole team involved in preparing for expeditions. And then, yeah, the typical day on the river, it is a very simple life out there. We get up in the morning, generally with sunrise, and have breakfast and coffee. Breakfast consists of just oatmeal and then a cup of coffee, and then we carry on. And then down the river, every 10 kilometers, we stop and do our research. And as we go along, all the biodiversity and people are called out. We stop for lunch, generally for an hour, where we eat the leftover cold rice and beans from the evening before. And then we carry on and do that. And we stop around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's also just a safety feature because after 3 o'clock, it gets cooler and the hippos are starting to move around a bit more to get ready for their night out of the river for grazing. And yeah, then we set up our camp and each person has a little two-man tent where we sleep in. And yeah, dinner is rice and beans. We do have our sort of camp management team out there that try to do their best to change up the flavors of the rice and beans. Yeah, it is a very simple life and good life out there. You very quickly realize you don't need more than what we have out there.
Sounds wonderful.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long does it take to travel typically that 10 kilometer distance?
It varies, depends on the flow of the river, but generally about 1.5-2 hours.
So you can make several stops over the course of your day. Interesting.
Yeah. So on average, I think we cover something between again, it depends on the rivers and the obstacles you have in the river. If they're rapids or if you have hippos blocking you, then obviously progress is not as fast, but something between 15 and 30 kilometers, that's our average we can do a day.
Let's talk about the water monitoring you're doing in particular, both the spot checking and the continuous data collection. Gertz, maybe you can kick us off just by describing for us what you're monitoring and how you're doing it.
Yeah, so as Rainer mentioned, on our expeditions, we stop every 10 kilometers and do a whole set of different samples, and one of that is our water quality samples, and we use Aquatrol 600s for that, since they're very easy to use. You connect your phone to them, they have a nice battery life, and you don't have to change the batteries through one expedition. And then we do sort of the standard parameters, including pH, conductivity, turbidity, and oxygen levels. Sort of those are the standard parameters. We do that every 10 kilometers down the river. And for example, when we go down rivers where we expect there are some pollutants in the water or some major agriculture on the riverbanks, we use different sensors. So that's where we deploy, or we use two Aquatrol 600s, where we have one with the standard parameters and then one with different sensors, including nitrates, FDOMs. We have then 8 different sensors taking water quality measurements.
So these measurements are kind of like a snapshot in time. So tell us a little bit about how the continuous monitoring kind of augments this project.
Yeah, so those measurements are the spot measurements, and we do repeat transects. So every year, for example, we follow the same route crossing the Okavango Delta, and we take a measurement at the same spot every year. So that just gives us snapshots every year to see how the river changes. But then we do have our sort of continuous monitoring, where we have 13 environmental monitoring stations, and there the Aquatrol is deployed permanently and connected to a data logger, and it uploads our data every hour. So we get hourly readings for those 13 stations down the Okavango system.
And these seem to be pretty challenging environments from some of the reading that I did on your website. So what made you guys choose to use the Aquatrol over any other instrumentation? And what have you liked about it in the project so far?
Yeah, so we obviously did some intensive research into which device to use. And yeah, as everybody knows that works with water quality, and these sensors do need calibrations fairly often. And we came across the Aquatrol 600, and yeah, there the calibration periods are quite far apart. So we don't have to go out every 2 weeks to recalibrate the pH sensor, for example. We had them out for about 3 months and we saw very little drift in the data. So that makes our life a lot easier. And it would be impossible for us to go out to these stations regularly. So if we can keep it to a minimum of 3 to 4 times a year, that helps our life a lot.
And what happens with all of this data that you collect, whether it's the spot sample data that you're collecting or the continuous data that you're collecting, where does all of that data go and how do people access it?
Water quality data, I guess it's quite sensitive, and it depends on the different governments how that is released. So essential, the data belongs to the governments, and they can decide how it's released. For example, I can give Namibia as an example. If you contact the relevant governmental department, you fill out a data request form, and most of the time they do release the data. But we also store the data on our database and use it and visualize it on a dashboard, which we are busy working on. And that's unverified data. So people can view it, but they can't download it, and it's not verified.
And I do have to say those visuals that you have on your website are fantastic. I know Helen and I were kind of browsing some of them yesterday and they were just absolutely beautiful.
Carrie loves data.
Thank you.
I do. I love data so much.
What are the factors that can affect the water quality in this area? What are you concerned about? What are you looking for?
So there's the human impacts, anthropogenic pollution, especially upstream, particularly on the Namibian side. Down in the Okavango Delta, we don't really have a lot of human activities that would cause fundamental deterioration of the water quality. So we have those upstream. And in terms of processes, because as I look at the water quality data, I consider, the water quality status, whether the water is fresh or polluted. I also consider the underlying fundamental processes controlling the water. And one of the major things that I see from the data is the role of the high rates of evaporation in the region in controlling the water chemistry or the water quality of these rivers. And because of the high evaporation rates that are occurring, especially in the Okavango Delta region downstream, we also have precipitation of salts that we find on the basin surface. And what happens is that during flow, those salts are dissolved and flushed into the river, and they modify the salinity of the river. So those are the two fundamental processes that I see controlling the water quality, the high evaporation rates and the salt dissolution. And then upstream is mostly anthropogenic pollution.
Excellent. And Reiner, what's at risk here? Why is it so important in this region? What could potentially be lost if the water quality isn't protected?
Well, you know, there's, what are the current figures, Gertsu? There's, I mean, over a million people, I think, that do rely on the water that comes down the Okavango, especially in Namibia. I think 70% of everybody in Namibia lives along the Kavango region, which is what they call the Okavango in Namibia. So it's for people, that water. And it's not like the water gets taken, you know, out of the river and cleaned and then fed back to people. Yes, there are some big towns that do that, that have a municipal water cleaning systems. But for the greater part, people just collect water from the river with buckets and take it home and consume it. And, you know, if it becomes polluted, it's a human problem. And of course, biodiversity as well. You know, you have, you know, these big center pivot farms, big commercial farms that are privately owned, that are sometimes subsidized. You know, their fertilizers subsidized. Maybe, you know, the fertilization rates aren't calculated properly, and you have a lot of excess nitrate and phosphate runoff into the river. Causes eutrophication and fish die-offs and other problems, as I think a lot of people that listen to this podcast would know. So those are the real dangers. And then, you know, microplastics and, you know, contamination from pharmaceuticals, all these things that, you know, because the Okavango River doesn't flow out into the ocean, it dead ends in the desert, that all that pollutant, it accumulates in the delta. And the delta, it has its, what we consider its liver or its kidney, the Okavango Panhandle. The last little bit of river before the delta forms is just a labyrinth of papyrus and reeds and hippo grass, which captures a lot of this, and we don't know how long that vegetation can hold on to these pollutants before, you know, something breaks. So it is quite vital that the water stays clean.
Thinking back to the construction of your continuous monitoring stations that you have, that you've already set up and that you're looking into, what actually goes into choosing a location for these and setting up one of these locations? What is it that you look for?
To start off with, I think it took us quite a while to pick these locations. Obviously, it goes quite a bit into who decides. To start off, we picked some locations, and then it had to be sort of approved by the local governments and the Okakom, which is the commission for the Okavango River. That's the commission that sort of keeps communication between all three countries. So once we had all of that discussed and decided, okay, these are the locations where we want to put them, then we sort of had to figure out how to deploy these things, as it's not easy. You have three different sensors. So you've got the Aquatrol measuring water quality, then we've got the weather station, and then we've got the water discharge meter. And we came up with the solution to putting these on bridges. I think on the website, you can see a couple of pictures where we deploy these. And from that, once we figured out we're going to use bridges, we had to change a few locations. But the broader picture stayed the same, where we wanted to have these stations sort of from higher up on the river, from near the source all the way down to the delta. So to understand the hydrology of the river and how rain affects the water quality and how long it takes for the water to flow down the river. And obviously working on bridges comes with its difficulties. So we do have two rope access engineers. We always fly in. They always do our installations with us. So they do the hard work. So they hang off the bridge, fix all the pipes down into the river where the Aquatrol goes in, construct the pulley system so we can pull the Aquatrol out to service it and calibrate it. So yeah, they essentially do the hard work. And then Rana and myself over the years have learned how to connect these sensors and do some troubleshooting. And then, yeah, once they're deployed, then they just sit there, and whenever we get close to them or drive past them, we'll quickly clean the solar panel, check that everything is fine. If we have time, we'll pull up the Aquatrol. If we see it's not working, just see what's working. And if we need to, we can replace it or replace the sensor.
So what are some of the challenges that you were facing when you had to come up with such a heavily engineered solution? Were you worried about flooding or vandalism or anything like that?
Yeah, so I guess working in Africa, vandalism and especially the solar panels are a big issue. People love solar panels. They do like to take them. So we came up with a solution and to have them in bulletproof glass and in these vandal-proof cases. So we have a small solar panel, which doesn't cost much in a very, very expensive case. If a solar panel gets stolen, the whole station goes down, and most of these stations are in remote places. It will take us months to go back. So, and there we have big gaps in our data. So I think that was the biggest challenge. And I think it's the most important one we've conquered, is to have constant power supply to these stations. And then the brain of the station, that's also in a vandal-proof box, the data logger and the battery. And then another interesting story is we deployed one station on an old blown-up bridge in Angola that was blown up in the war. And I think that's one of our cooler stations. It looks very nice, and it's got some history attached to it.
And not all those that might disturb a station are human.
Yeah, so those are the stations Rainer and Rob put up in the Botswana, in the Okavango Delta. They have come up with a nice system where they sink a tripod into the sand and put the Aquatrol in the middle. And obviously there you have to think about where you put them, as they're very little or very few humans, but you have elephants and hippos that probably could rub on them. It's a nice shiny pole they could use to scratch their back on. So yeah, that's another factor we have to keep in mind.
That's the first time that we've spoken with someone who is dealing with that potential concern.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever had to worry about that one in the field. No.
That's kind of fun. And you had mentioned that you have a lot more of these stations going in. Is that right?
Yeah, we should have another at least 10 going in this year. With those tripod type stations, because the reason why we had to use a tripod system, these are 6 meter long galvanized poles that we drill down into the sand with a water pump, and then connect them all together and put the aquatrol in the middle in a perforated stainless steel pipe, and then we have the box and the solar panel, everything on a pole going up from that. And it seems to work really well. We've been testing them for a while. They seem to work really well. We just can't put a discharge meter onto it. But obviously the aquatrol, the non-vented one, was it the vented one, can do good water level. And that's been working really well. So that we just use water level and then we eventually just get the rating curve and then we can get a good idea about discharge there. But we are planning to lose a few of them to elephants, especially elephants. But you know, you have to break an egg to make an omelet.
So are all of these new continuous monitoring stations going into the Okavango Basin, or are you expanding these continuous monitoring stations into other basins as well?
Yeah, we are expanding at the moment. We're doing a lot of our spot checks also. We've expanded into the Congo and the Nile Basin, the Zambezi Basin. And Gert's recently put a new installation in on the Zambezi system.
On the Congo.
And there'll be more coming.
Guarione, we know that you're a PhD candidate at UC Davis, and I'd love to hear more about the work that you're doing.
Right. So my PhD work focuses on really trying to understand how the water chemistry of the Okavango Delta change both in space and time, and the processes controlling those changes. Very important work when it comes to water quality monitoring and also for informing water management decision making in the Delta and the entire Okavango River Basin.
So what are some of the types of data that you're looking at as far as that trend analysis is concerned? Are you just looking at the data that's collected from the aquatrol, or are you looking at additional laboratory samples as well?
I look at data from sensors and also from water samples. So I'm interested in different chemical components, water quality parameters, as well as tracers that could help me to really decipher important processes occurring in the Delta, tracers like stable water isotopes, major ions. Yeah, and then the water quality parameters from OWP has also been very important in informing my investigation.
So you talked a little bit about evapotranspiration earlier,
right,
and some of the work that you're doing with that. Is any of this data that you're talking about now related to the evapotranspiration study?
Yes. So the Okavango Delta is in the middle of the Kalahari Desert, right? So it's very hot. And because of that, we have very high rates of evapotranspiration. And I can see that from my data, from all of the solutes that I look into. Solutes, I'm talking about dissolved ions in the water, right? So when I'm looking at how they change from the inlet to the Delta in Muhembo all the way down to the outlet of the Delta in Maung, we can see downriver enrichment in the solutes that I'm looking into. And that corresponds to isotopic enrichment. So I put in stable water isotopes to trace this evaporation, and I can see that from the isotopes. So we really know the importance of evaporation in modifying the water chemistry in this system. And it's very interesting, especially when we think about climate change, right? It's projected to increase air temperatures, particularly in Southern Africa, and that will mean more evaporation occurring. So it's been a topic of concern for me. I've been thinking a lot about it, like in the future, what's going to happen to the data. As I've mentioned before, this evaporation also leads to precipitation of salts on the basin surface. And if evaporation is increasing and the flow is decreasing, the flow from Angola, as Reina said, the data depends on the flow from Angola, right? If that reduces due to climate change and evaporation is also increasing, I always wonder if the data is going to be under the threat of salinization at some point.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like it's going to be a big concern going into the future. And, you know, I think some of these isotopes that you're talking about, you're comparing that across a transect over the course of one sampling time frame. But how do those trends look over time? So over the extent of the entire project, has anything changed that you've noticed? And it could be for the good, for worse?
Right. Yes, the chemistry is changing definitely over the years. And it's mostly also controlled by changes in the flow magnitude, right? The flood that comes from Angola, its magnitude change every year, right? So the years that we get low flow and sometimes that, from my data, that means sometimes I see high salinity. And then when we get high flow, we get a bit of dilution here and there, reducing salinity in the river, things like that. So yeah, the chemistry do vary over time and mostly modulated by the flow.
Are you building models then that take in all of the information from the stations and from the discrete samples to kind of be able to show what parameters are in the water no matter what time of year it is?
I'm thinking about models, but I had to make sure that I understand what's happening in the system right now, because it's a very highly dynamic system. So what you capture this year may be different from the next year. And in terms of building models, I had to spend some years to really capture what's going on, so that when I take that and feed that into the model, it will tell me something predictable. So I'm thinking about models. At the moment, I am informing solute cycling models for rivers in dry environments. So just insights on what controls solute cycling, in this case, how things like salts are cycled in basins like the Okavango River basins. So that's the kind of model that I'm building at the moment. But like I said, it's going to take some time to have predictable insights from that.
That makes total sense that it would be a pretty complex system or a pretty complex model to build. Yeah. So what do you think are the next steps in your project that you're working on? What are you looking at next?
I'm interested in the impacts of climate change on the water chemistry. So as I'm working through the water chemistry, I'm also keeping in mind how to build a model that will help us forecast climate change impacts in these kinds of systems.
Reiner told us in an earlier conversation that you're the recipient of the National Geographic's Pathfinder Award. So congratulations on that. And also that you are looking at setting up a lab back in closer to your home when you're done with your studies. Can you tell us a little bit about what your plans are?
Right. So I'm interested in joining the OWP, and they are the ones who are planning to start up a lab. And I'm very excited to be part of that journey and be in that lab, continue looking at the water quality stuff, the analysis, and the data, the writing. Yeah.
Do you see yourself getting into a Mokoro and heading out on an expedition?
Actually, it was my first time on a Mokoro in 2022 when I joined OWP in one of the expeditions in the Delta. So a very exciting experience. But yeah, I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Wonderful.
In fact, Babawane, her Mokoro got pretty much eaten by a hippo. Well,
didn't
eat it, but
oh my gosh!
It scrunched it between its teeth. But Hwabone at that point wasn't in there. She got away. But it was a hippo that was it was unfortunate because the hippo was kind of stuck in this deep hole. We didn't know he was there, and some of us came past. And then the hippo kind of came up for his breath and realized there were, Mokoros in front and behind him, and he didn't know what to do. So, you know, we saw him come up, so we quickly went to the side, and Hwabone managed to get out and get away from the Mokoro, but the hippo did choose hers and gave it a big couple of bites.
Well, we're glad. We're glad you got out. Oh my gosh, what a memory. And that is just...
Yeah, I had to jump into the riverbank.
Really? Oh my gosh, make a scramble. And that is what's just so intriguing about all of this as well. I mean, it's such important work in a critical area, but also just the experiences that you have had over the years that you've been out there. Gertz and Reiner, how many expeditions for each of you so far?
I don't know. I can't count.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gertz is leading, but... Yeah, I've been doing some catch up, but he's still leading. I think if you put it into kilometers, I mean you well over 10,000, I think.
Yeah.
Kilometers. I'm maybe around 6,000 or 7,000 kilometers. So
goodness.
And there's still ways to go for us.
Yes. So Gertz, in that time, I mean, what's been most surprising?
I think for me, it's just the beginning stages, working in Angola and just being so remote. So if you ever watch the movie, you can see how we struggled in the beginning, and yeah, literally there's no way out. So once you're in, you just have to carry on, and then just being very, very remote and in places that are untouched. Angola had the advantage of sort of conservation through war, so lots of these areas people couldn't go through and still can't, so there's still lots of landmines, so lots of areas are fairly inaccessible, and that just sort of preserved some of the areas. And I think we've discovered up to 120 new species to science, and that just for me is still mind-blowing that we can still do this in this modern day.
And for you, Reiner, what's been surprising or even, you know, perhaps sobering, or I don't know, what are some of your big takeaways?
I'm never going to beat Gertz's answer. But I guess for me, it's on the other side, really. You know, when you have done some of these pristine rivers, this incredible, beautiful, absolutely untouched and pristine habitat. You know, you see the people that are benefiting from these beautiful untouched habitats. People are happy, and I envy them in many ways. But then when you then come to areas where the river has been damaged and mismanaged, there's no fish left, the water is rotten, the trees have been cut down, the cows have eaten all the grass. It's quite surprising, and you see, sadness and difficult times for people. And we advocate, keeping ecosystems intact for people, because without people, conservation isn't possible. You can't exclude people from the picture. That's what we are trying to do as a project, is to go in there, find the data that is important for managing these systems, and then slowly but surely eliciting change through predominantly through community involvement.
Gert, you mentioned that some of these government agencies are actually the recipients of these data, and they're the ones that are able to give the data to others who are interested. What has the feedback been from some of these government agencies? Are they accepting of this project, or are they a little hesitant? What's the feedback that you've received?
The feedback is generally very good. People do like that we supply these stations and that they get the data. Obviously, we have no control in how the data is being used and distributed. But generally, everybody is happy and excited that these stations are going up. So every 2 years, we paddle the Okavango, so the Namibian section of the Okavango. And there, once we've paddled that, we host a symposium here in Namibia just to showcase and present our data we collect on that river. And as everybody knows, that section of the river is the river in trouble, and everybody has acknowledged that, and hopefully our data can help people do something about it and just realize that there is actually a big issue here and something needs to be done.
Have you guys actually seen any changes in behavior or practices or anything based on the data that you've provided?
We haven't seen much, and like I said earlier, we sort of the guys that collect the data and pass it on, and we're not involved in policy change or pushing that side. There are the NGOs, other institutes that do that. So we literally just provide the data and hopefully have that get into the right hands where people can do the change.
A big drive in our program this year is to find better ways of communicating the science, because we're quite a scientific organization. It's quite academic. Since 2017 we've published 55 peer-reviewed papers, but to get this out into the public and to get people to understand better, why water quality should be monitored and why it is important, is something that we need to do. And this is something that your podcast does, I think, which is great.
Reiner, it sounds from what you shared at the beginning that you have solid funding for this project. How far into the future does it go?
The funding that we secured, this is all the work of our founder, Steve Boyes. With endowments, his Steve Boyes vision, and he's there now with it, is to have a perpetual funding source specifically for the Okavango. The work that we're doing in the other basins will follow on. It waits to be seen where that goes. We start with expeditions and we take it from there. But the work in the Okavango is well developed. And the funding is going to be secure, hopefully eternal. That's why the relationship, the partnership between National Geographic and De Beers and the Wild Bird Trust, us, is called Okavango Eternal. Mm-hmm. It is to make funding eternally available and to protect the Okavango Basin eternally.
With data collection into perpetuity.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Keep that yardstick in the water all the time.
Gertz, how did you come to this project? What was your interest in the line of study and how did you get involved?
Yeah, so I've got a botany and entomology background, and back in 2015, I volunteered and helped my supervisor then, and he was appointed the lead botanist, and he asked me if I wanted to join him on this expedition. And then Steve did ask me if I wanted to stay on, and that's how I stayed on. Just a quick question, would you want to carry on? And it was a yes, and almost 10 years later, I'm still here.
Wow, that's great. Reiner, what about you? What's your background and how did you come to this project?
I have a PhD in nature conservation, and I've worked in many African countries. I've always been interested in rivers, and my speciality really is long-term monitoring. When I got this opportunity to go on the first on that first trip was in 2017. I'm fascinated by this job and I love it.
And Guabayone, how about you? How did you come to this course of study and what was your interest?
Yeah, growing up in Botswana, I faced a lot of water shortage and that just gave me so much interest in studying something that will somehow make me help my country preserve its water resources. I mean, 80% of Botswana is covered by the Kalahari Desert, so we don't really have a lot of water. So I grew up with that interest, learned about geology. I did my BSc degree in geology at the Botswana International University of Science and Technology. And then after graduation, I started my graduate school journey, starting with master's and then PhD in the US, focusing on hydrogeochemistry, which is basically water chemistry, working in the Okavango Delta. And I learned about the Okavango Eternal Initiative that Reiner talked about, partnership between the Botswana Wild Bird Trust, NatGeo, and DBS. And I reached out to the people in charge of the initiative, and they recommended me to talk to OWP people. That's how I got in touch with them. Actually, when they responded, we talked in 2022, and when they responded, they were like, oh, in August, we're actually leaving for an expedition. And that was a month before the expedition, I think. And then I expressed interest in joining them. And that's how we got to work together. And it's been amazing.
Good timing.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. If people want to learn more about the project or get involved in some way, where should they go?
They can go to our website, which is the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project. Just type that in. That's our National Geographic website. And then we have, if you just type in the Wild Bird Trust, you'll get another website, where you can also find the hydrological dashboard. It's an older version. We're working on a newer one with Esri, so it'll be quite a nice product. And then we're also on Instagram, Into the Okavango. What else, Gertz? What else have we got? Yeah, the film is called Into the Okavango. There's a new film which has just premiered. It's not out yet, but that is called Nkashi, Race for the Okavango. It's a brilliant story about a character that lives in the Okavango Delta, a Wayeyi bushman. Great story. And then we have the Guardians of the River podcast, which won at Tribeca. So that's a nice thing to listen to. And then what did you say, Gertz?
I think just our social media, most of them are Into the Okavango and on Twitter or X and Instagram. And then on Facebook, it's Okavango Wilderness Project.
Terrific. Well, thank you all for joining us. I know that you're busy, and I hope you'll stay safe out there. And we look forward to staying in touch and staying informed on the project. And I hope we get a chance to visit again with you in the future to learn more about what you're learning. So thank you all.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Kerry.
This is Aquapod, brought to you by In Situ. You can find more episodes and subscribe to the podcast on our website, insitu.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please listen, share, and help us spread the word. Aquapod is produced by Helen Taylor and Kerry Caslow, with a big assist from Josiah Holmland and I25 Productions. We look forward to bringing you more water monitoring stories from the field. Until then, take care out there.